Man, your hair was terrible. Still is.
we were in the middle of Mozambique, man.
I know exactly.
We weren't worried about hair.
Mm-mm.
And I can't remember.
You know where that was? It was the Serena Lodge.
Well, was it? Okay.
That was when we were on safari. Yeah, that's one. Right. You could see the elephants in the background.
True, because I remember them telling us that we would do one hard day, one easy day. One hard day. They wouldn't put two hard days back to back.
Well, you know, it was.
Can I introduce you?
We had a couple hard days back to back, but
yeah,
it was an incredible journey.
I have to introduce you, Tom. Hold on a second.
Powerful.
You know what I'm saying? His name is Tom Cochran. He and I have been friends a long time, and I believe Mrs. Cochran's doing some construction over in the corner. And I've found you where, Tom? Are you in Austin?
We are in Austin right now, buddy. It's okay. Good to hear your voice, man.
Thank you very much, Tom. you played me. We're going to talk about your new album. By the way, I saw three titles go by. I saw Sunday Afternoon Hang, Back in the Game, and Take It Home. Were they all considered album titles at one point?
You know, you always grapple with an album title, but Take It Home is actually not in any of the songs lyrically. It was going to be in Sunday Afternoon Hang, just as it was a throwaway line.
Right.
But I just love the term, because I always yell it at Kenny when we're jamming.
Take it home.
At the end of tunes, I say, take it home, brother. And so I think the phrase is appropriate, and I think it's a good title for this record, because the record deals with a lot of roots and a lot of influences that have been very, very important in my development as an artist and musician over the years, and as a young musician. And a lot of them are Southern roots, Terry.
Yeah.
That, as we both know, Canada, we excel in taking those roots and creating hybrids with them. With our particular style of Canadian, you know, rock and folk music and so on. And, there's been, you know, some fabulous bands in the past, whether they be, you know, blues bands or rock bands that have been able to take those influences and put them in their own form and in their own setting. And, you know, we've had people like Ronnie Hawkins, obviously, that have been instrumental in bringing that music to Canada, and the late, great Levon Helm.
And the band.
And, of course, you know, Robbie Robertson and all those,
who
is Canadian. And they brought that music home, you know, Hank Snow, if you want to go way back. So there's a lot of those influences on this record. And so I thought it was a pretty good title.
Very good title. Good title for a tour as well. How big was the move to Austin for you? That's the first part of the question, and the second one is, why not Nashville? Why Austin?
Well, first of all, and I want people to understand this, because it's very, very important to me, and we've talked about it ad nauseum over the years, Terry, that for me the most important thing is to be acknowledged and recognized at home. And home for me is, you know, and I know it sounds cliche, but it's all of Canada. It really is. I mean, I've lived in Vancouver, and I love it dearly. And I've obviously lived in Toronto and in Oakville, and I just consider all of Canada home. So it's important for me to be acknowledged at home and successful first and foremost at home. And you know, I think a lot of my compatriots, whether they're Jim Cuddy and the rodeo guys, you know, feel the same way. It's just important to us. And so my primary residence is still Canada. It's odd, because people always go, why Austin? You know, well, Austin's a wonderful place. I mean, they call themselves the live music capital of the world. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But there certainly are a lot of musicians here and a lot of clubs. Don't tend to pay them very well, but, you know, if James Dean, I think, was alive and living today, he'd have cowboy boots and roll-up jeans and a T-shirt, and he'd live in Austin.
Sure.
And you do see a lot of people here, a lot of people from California here. Not as many Canadians as you'd imagine, but a lot of people from the Northwest. Some of my good buddies are from the Seattle area, and you know, that have moved down here. And I guess the long and short of it is that it's a vital community. You know, I don't want to insult anybody that goes to Florida, but you know, it is quite a bit more vital as an art community and music community than Florida would be, or Arizona in some ways. So from that point of view, and then there's some practical considerations. It was easier to get the dog, our dogs. We had two dogs at the time, to drive them down here, and it's like driving to southern Florida, and
sure. And
I like the warm weather, and I like the driving. You know, life is a highway and all that, and that's where I come up with a lot of ideas and do some of my writing. Nashville, to me, is for musicians that are deep in the hunt, that play every single day, that want to do that all the time. And I don't particularly want to do that all the time. You know, I don't like to write in committees, and that tends to be the case in Nashville.
Sure.
You know, two, three, four, five writers sitting in a room, and, oh, I got another writing appointment in an hour. You know, I'm at a point in my life where I don't want to live quite that hectic, and as you know, we talked about it before. I've always been kind of a solitary cat when it comes to writing. I don't, you know, like other artists that I won't name, you won't see two, three, four, five writer names on my songs. There's only one song in this record that I wrote with Daniel Bouchard, who's a Canadian from Newmarket, but she lives in Nashville, and we wrote it in Nashville. So I can always visit Nashville, but the long and short of it is, you know, it's warmer here, and you know, so we're down here like five, 6 months. Kathy's probably down 6 months, and I'm probably down 4 or 5 months because of my travel and so on. So Toronto is still in Canada's primary residence. Spend a lot of time up on Georgian Bay as well, and Lake Huron. I got my studio. I did a lot of the recording for this record up there, and some of it down here, and then some of it in L.A., and some of it at my dear friend Gil Moore's place in Mississauga Metalworks, and we got some great sounds out of there, so... He's got an old vintage Neve console. Just aside to that, for the musos out there that might be listening to this, which, knowing you, Terry, there's probably a lot of musos listen to your shows, because you're a musicologist and you know what you're talking about. But Rupert Neve lives just down the road in an old hippie town called Wimberley here. Mm. It's a hippie cowboy town, sort of a hybrid of the both, and Rupert Neve, who's the inventor of the great Neve console and all those wonderful preamps, he's the guy from back in the 60s and early 70s, and he's just up the road. So you get a lot of people like that settle here. Dan Winter, the famous photographer, owns this one of the oldest gas stations in Texas down here, an old Texaco that dates back well over 100 years. And he's done like two or three, Time magazine covers. He's done. He's a world famous photographer. So you get a real nest of artistic people in the Austin area. You know, it's very cool that way. So that's the long and short of it. But I'm always surprised that a lot of people don't know that about Austin. You know,
I don't know how somebody either told me this, or I've read about it, or my bones told me that when you went down there, I got the impression that you were going to slow down, that you might, I wouldn't be surprised if I discovered that you had sort of retired, quote unquote, but then thinking about you and how you challenge yourself, I couldn't see you retiring. So where was the truth
there? Well, I think that how do you retire from this? This is,
it's true.
You know, like my dear dad always said to me, he said, Tote, that was my nickname, Tote, if you can make a living doing what you love, and he was a pilot, and he there was nothing better. If you can make a living doing what you love and make a living at your hobby, you know, God's smiling on you, you know. And so, you know, we've always, you know, every year I do my 20 shows, and we do charity, you know, I do charities, a certain amount of charity stuff here and there. And so I've never really retired. For making albums, yeah, I mean, that part of it has slowed down. So the last one was, 6 years ago, No Stranger, which I was very proud of. But, you know, that it just was time. You know, it's like a bird flying south. It's just something that starts to gnaw at you, and you know it's time.
Well, you got to do something with the tunes. You have to honor. If the tunes come to you, if the lines come to you, if the melodies come to you, you can't just shut them out.
Exactly. And I felt like... it was timely for this record. maybe not for a lot of people, because it's a different landscape out there, Terry, as you know. I mean, there's guys up on stage playing to 20,000 people, and they press a space bar, and they start pumping their fist up in the air. And that's the world we live in. And I'm not going to fall into the Tom Petty trap where I start knocking it and saying, you know, we made real music back when, but, you know, this is what I do. And you yeah. know, it's you're hard-pressed to hear a band that, you know, out there right now on radio or popular bands that are guitar bands, you know, and guitar is what I know, right? So we're kind of keeping that side of it alive a little bit, and for okay. the people that want to hear it, and it fills that void. And I know that, you know, rodeo guys are doing the same thing. And
sure.
They do it incredibly well and have a dedicated following. So, you know, if this ends up for, you know, a couple of thousand of my friends and fans or however many...
Oh no!
You know, gravitate towards the record, then, no, then great. You know, I but think, you, first and foremost, you got to make it for yourself.
No,
right?
Tom, those tunes are going to draw a whole new audience. Is this the same father?
Thanks,
is this the same Lynn Lake dad that you asked if you were doing the right thing? What was it? What did he say to you when you said, "Dad, am I doing that, the right thing?"
He said to me, "He said." No, I think you're not.
That's right, yeah.
But he said to me, but it doesn't matter what I think. And isn't that great
yeah.
if a dad can, that's the ultimate honesty, right?
Sure.
It doesn't matter what I think, Tote. He goes, because they thought I was nuts when I wanted to make flying a living after World War II and you couldn't do it. So he said, I followed my dreams and I've never had any regrets. He says, the only advice I will give you is I'll be really disappointed if you don't give it 150%. And then maybe at some point you know when it's time to hang it up. But that's the only... He said, you got to follow your dreams. And I really respected him for that, because he did say, no, I think you're nuts. But it doesn't matter what I think, you know?
Hmm.
And so he supported me, and I try to do that with my girls. And, you know, I think it's the best thing, you know, you best advice I can give to a young parent who's got young kids. You know, you got to let the kids have a certain amount of independence and encourage their dreams, you know?
Especially if they do it when they're young. If they do it when they're young, if they do something easily when they're young, that's maybe the road you should be paying attention to, because...
Yeah, encourage it.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't hurt to... You know, and by the same token, you know how dearly I love hockey. And you see, you know, moms and dads, when I used to go to the rink, you know, and play in my industrial league before I broke a rib and decided I better hang it up. you know, you see the stage parents with their kids, like, they're just, you know, they just push their kids so hard, you know. And by the same token, I think you got to be careful about taking that approach, because you can superimpose your dreams on your kids. You know what I'm saying?
Very true.
And that's not right. You got to let your kids find their own way. And man, I don't know about you, Tara, but when my kids were born, I knew from the moment they were born that they had a different soul. You know, that each kid has their own distinct soul, and they're malleable, and we obviously have big influence on them, but they are their distinct human beings and with a distinct soul. So looking back on Dad, you know, he was real encouraging that way, you know?
You know, we laugh about this quite a bit. It's they glamorized the life of the singer-songwriter artist, but you were sleeping in the back of a car. It was raining. You had left Winnipeg. You're on your way yeah. to somewhere, some sort of bump in the road. You're on tour, and you're saying to yourself, oh, man, I hate this. This is just awful. You were not the star you are now. None of the awards had come your way, so none of the songs, really. You're kind of feeling sorry for yourself. And then you see something outside the window. What did you see?
It was Terry Fox.
It was Terry Fox on one leg.
On one leg, and I saw him, and it was early morning. I'm going, what the heck? Why is the traffic stopped? And I'm leaning against the window, and there's drops of rain flowing down, you know, streams of water flowing down from the rain over the window pane. And I looked out, and he's running by, and you couldn't tell whether it was pain and tears or whether it was the water from the slight rain that was coming down, that was flowing down his face. And it really hit home. You know, I'd heard about him, but we didn't, it took a while, I think, for it to sink in. It took until that last day that he was running. And I saw him on the last day, so it was near Terrace Bay there in Northern Ontario. And it was just one of those powerful, cathartic moments in your life that make you go, how tough can this be, what I'm doing? When I look at a guy like that, and he's just giving it, you know, his all right to the bitter end.
Did you reference that? Did you reference that in a
song?
Yeah. Did you reference that in a song? That moment in a song anywhere?
Well, yeah. It's in the ones that I've known, and it's A Fight for Freedom, which is an unusual reference, I guess. But there's different ways that we fight for freedom, and Terry was fighting for freedom against the disease, not just for himself, but for other people mainly, and that's courage. That took a tremendous amount of courage, and I'm very, very proud of that song for him. I played it at the Walk of Fame, and I had the incredible, incredible honor of inducting him into the Walk of Fame in Toronto, and his dad and his brother were there, and it was a very, very powerful moment for me. So I knew that song had to be on the record. Oddly enough, the first verse is something distinctly, completely different that, again, you wouldn't necessarily associate with this same kind of struggle for freedom, but it indeed was a very important struggle for freedom, which I think was important not just for the United States, for instance, but the world's. You know, it was a civil rights struggle and Rosa Parks, which was a seminal moment. Mm-hmm. In that struggle, when she said, no, I'm not going to sit in the back. You know, I've been down so long, sir, that I feel like I've disappeared. And, you know, was the ultimate kind of expression of, there's nothing more you can do to me. I'm staying right here. And so there's different ways we fight for freedom, you know. And Terry's was one, fighting against the disease, and he started that whole trend of all these marathons and walkathons for different causes.
Sure.
And what a wonderful, wonderful, strong and brave human being he was, and, you know, such a short life. And again, I think really one of our great heroes is Canadians, you know.
And every year we run and walk on his behalf.
We do. And
all over the world, actually.
Yeah. And there's a Parkinson's walk I've taken part in that. But, you know, all these walks were inspired by you know, Terry's defiance against the disease. And, you know, God bless him. He's one of our seminal heroes in our country.
His name's Tom Cochran, and he's in Austin, Texas currently, and he has a brand new album, new music coming your way, and dates we'll tell you about in just a moment in February.
I hope you have a list of those.
I do.
Because I don't have a list.
I do. I wrote about February the 20th in Calgary at the Grey Eagle Event Center and February the 21st at the River Cree Event Center. And then March the 13th at Massey Hall. Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. I just want to... I've written down, what, 5 titles here. Maybe more. Anyway, Diamonds is the first single, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Diamonds... well, actually, we had Sunday Afternoon Hang out, and I was sort of precociously defiant, if you can be precocious at my age, that I was, because I kind of said, look, you know, it's a different world out there. Let's just put it out. It's the summer. And, you know, record company wanted to discourage it. So did management, who said, you know, Tom, we still got to set stuff up and blah, blah, blah. So it didn't get quite the attention I think it should have gotten as a summer single, because I think it's a definite...
Sure.
You know, good summer single song, a little bit tongue-in-cheek here and there, and touches again, you know, touches on country roots, obviously, but who knows, we might re-release that next summer.
Next summer. There's always a summer.
Bit of a head start.
There's always
What's
a
that?
Summer. There's always a summer.
Got to be a summer. There's always a summer, and there's always a couple of summer songs. You know, Life's a Highway was one for a lot of people, so we'll... you know, maybe next summer, that one. But Diamonds, yeah, it's a single. I think record company wanted that one out for Juno eligibility. Who knows? I don't know. But that's out, and I'm very proud of that one. And the history of that song, people say, well, Rihanna has a song called Diamonds. You got to change the title. I said, listen, I wrote that before she did. You know, I actually wrote that when a couple of friends of mine split up. I don't think Bill would be upset if I talked about it because he's the one that brought the song out.
Right.
And I wrote it for Tara McLean.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, Terry McBride discouraged it and didn't want her to release it. And it's been sitting around. And so it was actually written for her and Bill when they split up. And they're both dear friends of mine. And so that song was written. That was the circumstance of that song. And then Bill brought it out because Bill co-produced the record with me, my good buddy Bill Bell, who's been working with Jason Mraz as his music director.
Right.
And we wanted to do a record together for quite some time. So I said, Billy, help me out with the production chores because I can't handle this all on my own. And he brought that song out. He said, you got to do this song. I said, well, Billy, I wrote that for Tara to do, and it's about you guys, and do you really want me to do it? And he said, absolutely. And so I did the song and made a couple of tweaks to it, and Billy helped me with those tweaks. And we, I'm very proud of that song. So I think there's two songs on the record that go back a few years. That song would have been written for Tara back in 2006.
Sure.
And what's the other one? I'll think of it in a second. There's another one that I wrote a while back.
It'll come
back
to you. But
Prayer for Hope, which would be near and dear to your heart.
Of course.
Not that you were on that trip, but you, because of you, and I'm a great believer in providence and synchronicity and all of that, and we just converged. I remember I'd done with Skip Prokop, who's a wonderful man, great drummer, used to play for the Poppers, and he was doing work for World Vision, and he wanted me to do this 24-hour famine little radio show in Brampton. And so I agreed to do it because we had a sponsored child at the time, and I really liked and admired World Vision's work. So I did that, and then you approached me a little while later and said, Tom, you want to go to Africa with World Vision? And I said, absolutely, we got to do it. So you and I worked out a time that suited both of our schedules, and it was one of the most powerful trips of my life. You know, again, it changed a lot of things, as it did, I think, with Jan Arden, and I think you took Sarah McLachlan to Cambodia.
Right.
You did some wonderful work for them, and they appreciate it. I know Dave Toyson talks about it all the time, the great work that you did for them. Anyways, you and I, off we went, like two parts of Three Musketeers, away we went, and I guess Carol Froome would have been the third part.
She Froomey,
worked for World Vision, good friend of yours. I called her the Ice Woman, she was so tough in certain situations, and off we went to, and covered a large swath of Western Africa. Everybody, when I read stuff from time to time, Wikipedia now, where it says East Africa, but it was West Africa. You know, that was a powerful experience. Anyways, a few years ago, on an HIV initiative, we went to Kenya and met this family in Voi that just knocked me for a loop. And the names were very powerful. It was Margaret Sits by the Hill. And so the song is A Prayer for Hope. And I'm very, very proud. I think it's my favorite song on the record. And it's A Prayer for Hope. And Hope was her little daughter. They didn't know whether she had HIV yet. The mother had full-blown AIDS. The 10-year-old was taking care of the family. The grandmother was in the hut, and she was blind, and she apologized for the state of her house, just like somebody would in suburban Calgary or Edmonton or Vancouver. Oh, you know, the house is a mess, and it was just a hut, you know, a straw and mud hut. And Mercy was their caregiver, and she was an incredible woman, and she looked out for hundreds of kids in that area that didn't have parents, and she worked very closely with World Vision. And so that's hence the line in the song, Mercy, Mercy, we need more like you.
Yeah.
And the very powerful song, but I knew that one would probably hit home with you. So I wrote that after that trip, and that would have been 2007, I believe.
His
so those are the two songs that date back. The others are fairly recent. The others were written in over the last year and a half, 2 years.
He's Tom Cochran. I'm Terry David Mulligan. This is Mulligan Stew in the CKUA Radio Network. Tom, there's one day I remember, it, and I just realized that all of these events happened on one day. You'll probably remember where we were, but we flew in, landed on a strip, went to a, we walked by thousands of graves, some of them freshly dug. We got to a
Shangara.
We got to a camp. We knew that there was a doctor there, the, one of their chief medical men who was saving lives with his team as fast as he could.
Dr. Halepe.
We walked into a tent, and he asked about the woman that was lying there. And he was trying to explain what she was fighting, and someone came and tapped him on the shoulder and said, "She's just died." And it was a had a profound effect on me. We walked outside just to, we had to walk outside. We had to get out of the tent. We had to.
Well, do you remember the daughter was sitting there?
Yes.
Kneeling beside her mother, and she looked up at us. And at that moment, I saw my two girls in her eyes. It was, I guess psychologists would call it transference.
Right.
And I couldn't breathe, you know, and she looked at us as if to say, "Why are you standing there with your pens and your notebooks and your cameras, and why didn't you save my mother?" And that's, without saying a thing, that's what I read in her eyes. Very powerful experience, you know, that. Louisa was another one. I wrote a song called "The Party's Not Over," but Louisa, remember, she had the big growth on her throat, and she had witnessed her whole family butchered by machetes. And that's how they affected people, was they always left one survivor to tell the story.
That's
and
right.
This poor little girl was there, and Dr. Halepe was tending to her.
Yeah.
And this guy wouldn't leave, and he had been there for a couple of months, and he looked like his clothes were all crisp and neat and clean. He was just, he was an incredible man. And he worked with World Vision for quite a few years after that.
I don't know if you can remember this, but I think Basil was shooting with us that day. And
wasn't he great?
And it was so hot in that place that his Betacam stopped working. And the only thing that worked was the little handheld that we had. And thank God it did, because the kids started to sing. You challenged them. You said, you want to sing a song?
Yeah. And when do you remember that? I think that was our next trip when we went back and the war was over. Because that the first trip that we're just talking about, we're in that tent. We witnessed that terribly tragic, sad event. They were still at war.
Yes,
remember that?
That's right.
And we were in some nasty areas.
Do you remember the flight out? Do you remember the flight out? You're a flying guy.
It was just, I remember the pilot in my plane, and you were in the back seat.
That's right.
Was whistling "Onward, Christian Soldiers," and we're flying. We're flying about 100 feet along the Zambezi River, and he says to me, "Well, if we have to go down here, the worst wouldn't be over because it's guerrilla territory."
And he
wasn't talking about guerrilla, the animal. He was talking about the terrorists, the fighters. And I thought, oh, my goodness. And he's going, "We'll follow this river down, and we'll get to the ocean."
Because of the storm.
We were
a storm.
Zero visibility.
None. And you turned around and looked at me, and I knew that your dad was a pilot and you knew how to fly planes and things. And you gave me a look that went, "Well, I don't know."
I gave you a look like, "I hope we get out of this."
And
one.
I'm in the back. I have no control over this plane. And I'm thinking, come on, just get me there. Just get me back. Please just get me back.
Yeah. Remember, we got back. It was a white cane landing.
Yeah.
And we waited, and we couldn't reach Carol,
the second plane,
and there was a young kid from BC that was flying second plane.
That's right.
A smaller plane, a 206, and we couldn't raise him on the radio, and we thought, they're done.
Yeah.
And we waited, and we waited, and bang, they flew through that bank of clouds. Do you remember that?
I remember it like it was yesterday.
And we went, oh my God, and we were so relieved because they had made it through.
I wanted a beer.
And we got one. Okay.
Yes, we did. It was warm, and I didn't care.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that was all in one
day.
Got
a Tusker. Remember that all they would drink was Tusker. And at that time, we didn't have bottled water. So we used to have to use. Remember, I remember that first trip, I brought that water purifier, and it just tasted awful.
Yeah.
It had iodine and some other stuff in it, and you used to filter the water through that, and it was just, it was brutal.
All right, I don't know how I can pick this up, but let me just carry on with a couple of titles here, Tom, okay? When the Light Starts to Fade, a little New Orleans mention and riff in there.
I love that song because it kind of it harkens back to one of my favorite records, Rhythm of the Saints, Paul Simon, yeah. Because Paul Simon, loved the man. He's always been such a great musicologist and would create wonderful hybrids with his music. But anyways, that one is very New Orleans and touches on an experience I had with Kath doing her own thing I think the drums that Gary Craig played in there are just beautiful. You know, he really captured the essence of it.
And the track that I want to put together with, I'm going to play them back to back, is Back in the Game, which has got this sort of swingy, part blues, part New Orleans romp to it.
Well, it's really, Terry, what it is Texas swing, and it's like that's Austin coming through. You know, I remember Kath and I went to the Continental Club in Austin. Anybody who goes to Austin has to go to the Continental Club, and you feel like you're stepping through a time warp.
Yeah.
It's like late 50s, early 60s vibe. It's got the Continental Grill sign against this red velour curtain. And we went in there one night, and we heard Monday night was their swing night. So we thought that would be kind of interesting. We'd get there early, and we got there. We were the only ones there. And I'm sitting there nursing a beer, and Kathy's nursing her wine. And this band comes in, starts setting up. I think they're called the Marshall Dale Band. And the girl sets up her piano, and she couldn't be more than, 20, 22, 23 years of age. And she sets up her own piano. She's the first one. And she starts playing jazz with her left hand, and she's putting her makeup on with her right hand with the little mirror on top of the piano. And then the drummer rolls in, starts setting up her drums. They nod at each other. She says, "Hi, Hank, how are you?" And she just keeps going, doodling away. And the band just starts rolling in, and this music, just by osmosis or whatever, just starts evolving, right? And then they start playing full-on swing. And a lot of the stuff that you probably heard Downchild Blues Band in the past play or Powder Blues, yep. From Vancouver play, yep. And Doc Fingers and some of those guys. And just a classic, swing stuff from the 50s. And they were just kids, and she had overalls on, and they all had torn jeans. And then these kids start rolling in that are like college kids with ripped shirts and jeans and stuff. But their shoes were distinctive because they had dance shoes on, like Capizios and stuff. And they start dancing, and I felt like it was Cirque du Soleil. And Kathy and I are in the middle of the room, and within an hour and a half, all these kids are dancing, and it was a whole kind of movement here that is so cool, because you get kids doing this old style of swing dancing, and some of it was jitterbugging and stuff, and they're just kids, they're just college kids, and they're incredible dancers. It was powerful, and we want to do at some point a video shot there with a lot of these dancers and do Back in the Game, because that'd be fun. I really want to play that at the Continental Club and do it. But, it's. I mean, a lot of the record, Terry, talks about the mythical troubadour, the drifting musician,
the hobo.
Some
life.
Of that, some of that's died a little bit, yeah. Right? It's not quite the way it was back in the day, but it's still there in its own way, and about a rock and roll hobo, kind of drifting from place to place, playing his music, and. That song kind of touches on it and about, bottoming out a little bit and saying, man, I'm gonna, you have that cathartic moment, you clean yourself up and you get back in the game. And
can we
so
read
it's
any
kind of appropriate in
can,
some way.
Can we read anything into the title Back in the Game as though perhaps you'd stepped away from it and then came back to it, or should we just ignore that?
No, I think a little bit. I think you can. Absolutely. I think it's always you always feel like, and then there's the cup reference, which some people relate to NASCAR. I kind of relate it to hockey.
Sure.
And, yeah. It's hold my drink, I'm back in the game, that's that valiant struggle, to regain the cup, to struggle on, to, you know, in spite of the odds, you know, you clean yourself up and you get back in it, whether it's music or whether it's sports, you know. It's what makes us tick, you know, as a country. And so I think that'll touch a lot of people. Plus, it's a lot of fun. The song is, I think, the most up-tempo song on the record. And we did a few mixes that were cleaner and more pristine as mixes. And I just ended up with something that sounds really live and like it's busting out of the speakers, because that's kind of the essence of the song, you know?
Yeah, you carried those songs for a while. I mean, you played them for me in your hotel room. Did those mixes survive? Are those the ones that we're hearing?
No, the mixes were, I remixed most of it.
Yeah.
But that particular mix, yeah, that I went back to the one I played you in the hotel room, okay, just because it had such a great vibe.
Yeah.
And it changes once you master it, and that you dress it up a little bit, but it's pretty honest, and I think most of the record has that live vibe. You know, we wanted to. There's a lot of subs on the record. You know, the bottom end, the bass that waffles around a bit here and there, just as it would in a live room. And that was sort of the essence of the record. And I wanted to make sure that we captured that and didn't lose that vibe. You know,
Tom Cochran, Mulligan Stew, T.D. Mulligan. Here's just a one-off question that just popped into my head, and that was, I see a nice little trend that I encourage, that I really like, and that is that some artists are going back and doing small tours, recreating an album from their archives, doing it from front to back the way they recorded it in the studio, or where they mixed it and mastered it in the studio, and then just going out and do it like a Blue Rodeo, I think, did it fully, completely, the Tragically Hip are doing that now. If you decided to do this, just hypothetical, which album would you do front to back if you were to do it?
I would probably say Neruda. Neruda was to me, you know, it may be this one down the line, but I think Neruda, to me and to a lot of people, with the inclusion, I think, of Lunatic Fringe, because I think on the 60 Minutes with, yeah, in the States, they ended up releasing Neruda with Lunatic Fringe included.
Yeah.
And one other song included, I can't remember which one it was, maybe White Hot. And so I, you know, might add a couple of those, but that would be a real fun record to do live. It's cinematic, you know. Yeah. I did the whole first side of Neruda as a suite of music, and there's themes that reoccur.
Very cool.
Musical themes. So it would probably be Neruda, yeah.
So these dates in Calgary, February the 20th at the Grey Eagle and 21st at the River Cree, will this be acoustic versions of this album? What are you going to do?
No, this is full-on Tom Cochran with Red Rider, and I think because of the nature of it, and we want to make sure we give, you know, everybody the bang for the buck, it's you know, we don't want to leave out a lot of the old stuff that I'm sure people are going to come to hear, but we want to play a real good complement, okay, of the new stuff, at least five or six of them. So we're probably doing the tour, and this isn't etched in stone yet, but we're probably doing it just us. We won't have an opener. Now, with that said, there's a couple of people I'm considering right now that would be in the band that also have careers of their own. So it doesn't say that they might not do a couple of songs starting off, and then we come in. It just depends on the venue.
Okay.
But so it's going to be a real kind of musical review. There's going to be, the band's going to be, you know, six or seven pieces.
Wow. Is Massey Hall going to be a recording event?
You know, we've discussed it, and it's easier to do now than ever before. So I think probably a lot of the tour we're going to do that, you know, with Pro Tools, because it is an easy thing to do, easier, you know.
Yeah.
Now to do it, you know, there's obviously different levels of that. You know, you can really get pretty fancy with the way you approach it, and a lot of high end microphones and that. I don't know how, you know, if we're going to do the whole tour that way, but we probably will augment the tour in Massey Hall by having some a good recording engineer do it with some good mics, because that venue, to me, again, you know, a lot of the songs, a lot of the influences, whether it be the band who, you know, and that's the thing about you, Terry, like, you picked that out right off the bat. you said, you know, boy, the ones that I've known reminds me of the band a little bit, and so does this other song. And those are our roots, you know. That's kind of, they're artists that really impacted me. And, you know, J.G. Cale, another one, and so on. And we talked about Paul Simon and, of course, Dylan. But, you know, there are a lot of those roots on this record. And Ry Cooder,
yep.
Another one. So, I mean,
yep.
We're going to have, you know, it's you were incredibly intuitive when you heard it. And being the musicologist you are, you picked that stuff out. So it's kind of a tribute to those artists as well, you know.
Well, how you feeling, Tom?
I'm feeling great. I'll tell you, it's Terry, you know, the thing about making a record is people don't realize, that's great. Like, why aren't you doing that every second of the day? And I put so much of myself into it that it takes a lot out of you. As much as you get out of it, it's like self-therapy, and it takes a lot out of you, and it can be a little bit harder on your relationship and that, because I get pretty intense when I make a record, so it's got to be the right time, and you do it. So it's really wonderful. You know, I just finished mastering on last Friday, and got it just the way I wanted it, and it's good to have it off the desk, and I'm looking forward to performing it. You know, that's really, at the end of the day, how the whole thing comes to life again, is getting it right. And Kenny, I can't say enough about Kenny Greer, and it's so good to be back with him over the last 10 years, because we were a bit estranged. We weren't talking that much for about 10 years there, you know, over the Mad World period and Ragged Ass Road and all of that. And we're working together again, and it's just, he played some exquisite stuff on this record with steel guitar,
yep,
primarily, but also his mandolin stuff, and you know.
Did he do banjo too?
Yeah, no, I did banjo. I played banjo on this record,
nice.
And I apologize for that to any of the real banjo players out there. But I muddled through it, and I'm really proud of some of the stuff I played. It's quite different. Okay. But Kenny played a lot of he played ukulele, tenor guitar, and mandolin, and so did Bill. Bill played a couple of things on mandolin, but Kenny played some really wonderfully intuitive, tapped in parts that really, again, because we, you know, even before I met Kenny way back in the day, he was in a band called Bear Mother, and I was in a band called Harvest, and we were doing a lot of band songs, and we did a lot of, you know, real roots music, and so we come from the same same neck of the woods that way.
Finally, I got two questions, two big questions. One is, 2006, No Stranger?
2006 or 7, yeah.
Somewhere,
yeah,
in there.
It's been a bit.
Can you believe how much the music business has changed in those years?
No, it's...
Do you recognize it?
Can I believe it? Not really. I mean, you know, people... It just seems like, and I'm sure you go through this, every parent, every uncle, every aunt has kids that, oh, my kid's making music. And I think that's wonderful. But they come to you for advice. They come to me for advice. Uh-huh. And I go, I have to be honest in a lot of cases. I don't know what to tell them because, you know, I've got a dear friend here in Austin whose son has got a... And producers, they talk about producers are now the performers.
Yeah.
So these guys are like remix producers, you know, with EDM music and trance music and that. And that's kind of, you know, where that's at right now. And it's kind of a big movement. And, you know, Michael asked me to give him advice. I said, Mikey, you know, it's a world that I'm not familiar with because, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not a remixer, and I don't understand. I do understand that side of it. You know, I love, you know, I tend to love things like Avicii, for instance, which to me create hybrids of the music. The side of it I am not crazy about. I got a buddy by the name of A.J. Cole, who wrote a wonderful song called Colors, and then Glenn Morrison did the song. Well, it's A.J.'s. A.J. wrote the song, you know, but Glenn produced it and reworked it, and it's his name on top, and then featuring A.J. Cole, you know, and same with Avicii, it was Aloha Black, right?
Yeah.
that did Wake Me Up, and just a wonderful song. And a little about Black basically is an English folk singer. And but I love that kind of hybrid. I love it when you can make hybrids out of different musical genres. So you take the dance genre and you combine it with guitar and roots music, and that's basically what Avicii did with that, and he did it with the guy from Brother Where Art Thou, and I love those kind of hybrids. So, you know, I can appreciate all kinds of music, you know. So I think there's some good stuff being made, that's for sure, and there's some wonderful artists out there right now. Some kids that are making great country music. I think it's pretty vital, and that's where you're going to find a lot of the real guitar stuff, and some of the real rock is in country now. And you know, look at Rascal Flatts covering Life's a Highway, which was massive for me and them. And those are good trends, you know. Mm. And but there's different trends in different areas. It's not like, I think there was a time when if something was big and it became part of the pop culture, it was everything you heard at that time. You know what I mean? Now there's a lot of different genres of music, but that particular type of EDM trance music that's being done by remix artists and producers is a pretty big movement right now.
I played, by the way, just for your information, I played Christmas All the Time on my recent Christmas show
on the
20th. Love that song, and love the fact that I can play it. But it reminded me of something. You went to Kandahar? Kabul?
I went to Kabul.
Yeah. You sang All the King's Men, an acoustic version, I think, with Tara McLean.
Yeah.
For
I did.
Two of our military who had...
Oh, no. I was there with Davnet Doyle. Who sung in a band with Tara.
Okay.
They're good friends, and they were in Shea together. But, I was over there with Davnet.
And had we lost two of our members of the armed forces?
We did. Two of the first guys to die, other than the guys that were killed in a friendly fire incident.
And did you just happen to be there at that time?
No, you know how it came apart about Terry? It was powerful. We were in the officers, not lounge, because people get the wrong idea
what
that is, but their canteen where you get lunch. And it's a cafeteria-style thing in a tent. And this gentleman came up to me. He had full regalia on. He had the vest on, real strapping guy. And he said, you know, I'm Major so-and-so, and you know, my boys are going out on patrol, and we just wonder if you guys would come over and say hi and maybe, you know, say hi to these guys, because these incidents had happened just prior to that, and it was an IED had blown up and killed Robbie Barenfinger and Robbie Short. And I said, you know, yeah, just give us a minute, and absolutely, we're going to come over. So I rounded up Kevin Fox, who was with us as well, played cello and guitar, and Davnet Doyle, and we brought our guitars, and we went over there, and these guys sat there, and these guys all looked like a really, really buff version of Ed Harris, you know. I mean, they were strapping guys, and we sat there in front of this monument that they had built for Robbie Barenfinger, Robbie Short. And these guys, big strapping guys ready to go out on patrol, were crying. And, you know, that's when you realize, man, I'm glad I'm here. Like, it's the least we can do to support these incredibly brave Canadians. And, I was an honorary colonel. It was a great honor for me for 6 years with the 409 up in Cold Lake. And I got my honorary dog tags, but they're the real thing. And I wear them as a tribute to our troops, you know, because my dad, and I touch on it in Christmas All the Time. And again, you probably know this, Terry, and you know, he was in the RCAF, he was very proud of his tenure. He actually stayed a little bit longer in World War II to fly people in and out of Nuremberg. And So I'm very proud of Dad for that, you know, and he instilled in me a lot of have a lot of respect for our troops, and that was a very, very powerful trip.
So
as well. It was moving, yeah. But to see these big strapping guys that are all set and decked out to go out on patrol, knowing that they're in danger, and missing home.
And a long way from
play
home.
Play those songs and have those guys cry. Yeah. It was pretty powerful.
So that's why I'm going to finish with All the King's Men, okay?
Okay, brother.
Tom Cochran, Mulligan Stew, CKUA. Oh, man. Hold on a second. This is just off the record. Did you?
What about it? I'm not like.
No.
You're
okay.
You and Cuddy are unbelievable. We went to South Africa last spring.
Hold on a second. Just a second. He's Tom Cochran, and this is Tasting Room Radio. I'm Terry David Mulligan. Tom, now that we've finished talking about music, can we talk about wine just a second? I mean, because I know that Cuddy, we all have a nice friendship here, and Cuddy will talk about wine at the drop of a hat. How are you and wine? What's your relationship to wine?
My relationship is I love drinking it. I know my Pinot Noirs to a certain degree, and that's what I like drinking. I like Cote de Rhones as well.
Wow.
So I tend to like what I call the softer wines, because if I start drinking heavy cabs or
Barolos,
Barolos or Super Tuscans, it can get out of hand. So I tend to like the wines that I call softer wines, that are, to you, probably like drinking grape juice. But the Pinot Noirs, I think, are wonderful. And that's what I tend to gravitate towards, because they don't hurt me as much.
How about Oregon? You like Oregon Pinots? Have you tried Oregon Pinots?
I do. I love Russian River.
Yeah.
And I love Oregon Pinots. Mm. And, I think some of the best Pinots in the world are being made out in the West Coast, for sure. The Oregons have been sort of underrated. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well,
but
they also
have come into their own the last couple of years.
They also haven't. They got to learn how to market themselves. They.
Yeah.
The stand
up. I remember when I was in Portugal. I really loved
Portuguese
wine.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a clue, and I didn't either. I didn't realize that they had such wonderful wines, and I don't even know what you call half. What would you call? I mean,
well, no, they
people
do
know that port comes from Porto, but it's not really a wine.
No,
it's
they do field blends, Tom, and one of the most famous field blends is the guy puts together 32 varietals that he has in one field. He just grows them and then throws them together. Nobody else does that. Nobody.
No, and then they taste wonderful.
Oh, so fantastic.
Know? I've had some just incredible Portuguese. I think it's partly the weather. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It's partly Portugal.
And good soil, yeah.
It helps if you're in Portugal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And how about Kath? Is Kath like a white?
Kathy's a white wine drinker, yeah. She's a Chardonnay gal when she drinks white wine. And she's close friends with Tito, who's making just making incredible headways with his handmade, I don't know how you can call a vodka handmade, but it's Tito's vodka.
All right.
So she'll have the odd Tito's vodka, but she likes her white. And I'm not, I like to get straight to the red. I know it's fashionable to have a white to cleanse a palate and then go to the reds afterwards, but I tend to go straight to the reds.
All
and Pinot Noir would be it. Cote de Rhones, again, I love, and Chateauneuf du Pape, which are slightly heavier.
Sure.
Come from the same region, correct me if I'm wrong, in France, but I love those wines.
Yeah, Languedoc and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thanks, Tommy.
And unlike Breaking, was it Breaking Sideways, or what was the movie?
Sideways.
With, Sideways.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do enjoy the odd Merlot. And I think that was an inside joke in that movie, wasn't it?
It was an inside joke.
Because he talked about a particular wine, and it was a Merlot.
Yeah.
But he said, I'll never drink Merlots. But he was talking about a wine, and it was a Merlot that he liked. Yeah, so there you go, buddy. So we got to come out. When I'm out there, hopefully I'll see you, and we can have a glass or two, and you can educate me more like Cuddy tried to do. It was so funny. We were in South Africa, and Cuddy would take over the wine tasting night, and the sommelier that was there, that was brought in by Gold Plates, because we're raising money for the Olympics with these trips, was getting so bent out of shape, and he was complaining. He said, "You don't see me trying to sing Blue Rodeo songs. Why is he up there talking about wine?" So it was funny, but Cuddy knows his stuff, as you do.
Here's your last question. That is, what's Christmas?
And you know your music, Ter.
Thank you, man. Thank you. What's your Christmas like? Are you going to go back home? Do you stay in Austin? What are you going to do for Christmas?
No, we're going home. Got to have snow for that, and we'll head to the cottage, which is where my studio's at. But we'll have bonfires up there, and unfortunately, Evan's not coming in. My daughter works in New York, and she's in fashion, and she's just got a promotion, so she's going to be late coming in, so we won't see her till the 27th. But okay, we'll spend it with Cody, my other daughter, and her boyfriend, Stephen Appleby Barr, who's an incredible artist, making wonderful inroads. I think Getty just bought one of his paintings, Getty Lee, and we'll spend it with them, be quiet, and I'll see my mom. My dear mom is almost 94. And ticking strong, and my doctor says to me, you know, stress is the big killer. Stress will kill you. And I say, you haven't met my mother. My mother lives on it. My mother lives on stress, the dear soul. She's great. So we'll see her, and I'll hopefully see my sisters as well. And but it'd be fairly quiet, and that's the way we like it. New Year's we'll be at the cottage with the girls.
Will you play any music? I mean, will you play on the old jukebox? Will you play any tunes?
Yeah, I'm gonna. I'll probably pull out the guitar a little bit. The girls try to discourage it, but I'll pull out the guitar.
Cuddy says that his Christmas starts when they play Robert Earl Keane's "Having the Family Over for Christmas," where it's all.
Well, you know where he's from. He's from down here.
Yeah,
he's an Austin dude. There's some great songwriting heritage here, Terry, and these guys, you know, whether it's Guy Clark or Robert Earl Keene or McMurtry and of course, Towns Van Zandt,
yep,
the late great, and his son, again, lives in the town where Rupert Neve is, Wimberley, just down the street, this hippie enclave, but Robert Earl is just out, I think he lives up in Fredericksburg, but he's, you know, it's interesting about Texas writers. They are so passionate, you know, Dublin Blues and some of these songs, but there's a certain, they try to avoid, the songs will make you cry, but they try to avoid overt, you know, being overtly emotional. Do you know what I mean? It's a Texas thing. It's a cowboy thing, I think. You've got to be tough to the bitter end, you know, and it's interesting. And think about that when you listen to a Texas writer. The next time, you know, even Lyle, in some ways, there's always a tongue-in-cheek, you know, well, you know, but I do spend a little time as a rodeo rider thing to their music, you know, and it's interesting, you know, you pick up on those nuances. Canadians tend to be more
straight out,
you know, more emotional, more overtly emotional. We're more in touch with our feminine side, you know what I'm saying?
There you
brother?
Go, Tom. There you go.
So I've picked up a lot. I think some of that's rubbed off in my music, the tough cowboy, you know, oh, it's just a flesh wound. You know, I only, you know, cut off my toe roping that steer, you know, whatever it is. You know, it's just, you know, there's a certain thing about their writing that way.
Merry Christmas, Tom.
Same to you, buddy. Where are you spending it?
Oh, I'm right here. And then we're going to end up between Christmas and New Year's. We'll be on Salt Spring with Sean and his girls.
Happy Christmas.
Thank you.
Okay, brother.
Thanks, buddy. Bye.
Hey, man, that was awesome. Yeah, you just.